My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of the Good, the Bad, and the Hungy AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines, and we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Music of the Mat Remix on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. I am your host, Andrew Rich, joined today by a returning guest. It's Paul Wedding. Hello again, Paul.
Hey, Andrew. Glad to be on again.
Glad you're here. Yeah, definitely. Glad we both survived that insane winter storm from a few days ago that just clobbered the country. I mean, living in New England, I'm used to snow. But it had been a good while since we had like a really big snowstorm, and boy, did this thing pack a punch! And down in your neck of the woods, Dallas, and a good chunk of Texas, there, you guys got hit too.
Yeah, we still got. It's cleared away a lot, but there's still a good amount of ice and snow out there. I mean, shut the whole Metroplex down there for a few days. I think they just canceled school again tomorrow, so almost the whole week's off. And I spent like 4 days at a hotel right next to my office, which was nice. But it was an experience.
Yeah, I imagine. How do you guys prepare for snow down there? Because, you know, up here we've got like a fleet of snow plows, mountains of salt and shovels and snow blowers out the wazoo. We're armed and ready. But what's it like where you live?
They didn't really break anything out. I think they sand the roads, that they salt the roads, which doesn't help a whole lot. I mean, we still had tons of traffic backups and crashes and things like that. But mm-hmm. Other than that, I mean, I never see any plows out in the area or anything. So yeah, it's we're a little undergunned here.
Yeah. Yeah. In my experience, never be afraid to over prepare. Because in recent years, we've had forecasters be like, oh, a foot of snow is coming to Boston and everyone's getting ready. Everyone's getting the groceries out there. And then it's like 2 or 3 inches at most. And you feel a bit silly, but it's better than the opposite. That's for sure, Paul. So. Well, anyway, today's episode here is appropriate for this time of year, because we are in the middle of Hollywood awards season. We had the Golden Globes a couple weeks ago. We had the Oscar nominations come out recently. The Actor Awards are next month as well. So there's no better time to do a show that I'm calling Absolute Cinema. It's a phrase that has popped up a lot in recent years when it comes to people praising something. Sometimes ironically, they'll say it was absolute cinema. There's the meme with Martin Scorsese raising his hands up, and wrestling is no different. You know, I've seen plenty of people post a clip online, typically WWE, and say, oh, this was absolute cinema, or scenes, or I got chills, bro, for real. You know, it's become internet shorthand. And the funny thing is, usually they're not talking about a wrestling move. It'll be for like an entrance, or it'll be something like Roman Reigns staring at Jey Uso, or it'll be Seth Rollins making a face. Oh, absolute cinema. It's never like Mark Briscoe hitting the cutthroat driver, or Dragon Kid hitting the Ultra Huracan Rana. We never seem to get absolute cinema for that, Paul. It's a damn shame.
Yeah, you know, I think Genichiro Tenryu throwing Atsushi Onita into an electrified steel cage is pretty cinematic, but seems like all the attention goes towards, you know, AJ Styles fighting The Undertaker in a graveyard and things that I don't really care for at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me it seems like a confluence of the meme being popular around this time, but also where wrestling is focused now, especially American wrestling. The actual wrestling part of wrestling isn't the in thing. It's not the appeal for a good chunk of the fan base. They like the entrances, they like moments and mid-match promos and acting, drama, and the way wrestlers react to each other, and all these things that are used to, you know, to supplement pro wrestling, but are now the main focus on how they tell their stories. Hence why we get all these comparisons to cinema. Despite the fact that a lot of this absolute cinema in wrestling nowadays is not that good, The people tweeting it don't come across as big cinephiles, Paul.
Yeah, if I have to listen to a crowd sing along to Adam Copeland's theme song one more time, I can't handle it.
I do like the song, but I agree with your sentiment for sure. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, this episode, Absolute Cinema, we are going to play songs from movies. Now, that could mean songs made specifically for a movie. It could mean songs that were just picked to be in the movie. It came from elsewhere. It could mean score. The door is open here. And the reason I picked you for this episode, Paul, is because a few months ago, I joined Letterboxd. I took the plunge. And became one of those annoying Letterboxd people, and you're on there too. So yeah. I figured you're the right man for a movie-centric episode like this, and we can have ourselves a little bit of a fun chat about music in movies. Because much like, you know, wrestling entrance music, it's hard to imagine movies without music in them. They're just so linked, Paul.
Sure, yeah, I appreciate it. Those are, you know, my two biggest passions in life, arguably, are wrestling and movies, and those are kind of. They kind of fight each other for the top spot, but I love them both, and particularly, you know, a great use of a song in a movie. So I'm excited to talk about it.
Definitely, definitely. Well, let's get to the music here. We have 10 picks each and a playout song at the end. I am warning people right now, I will be throwing out some quotes here and there, like an annoying little movie nerd. Just brace yourselves for that. But Paul, you are the guest. You'll go first. What's your first pick?
Sure. So when I was coming up with my list, you know, my first thought is musicals, and my favorite musical is a Brian De Palma movie from the 70s. Kind of a cult classic, but surprisingly influential. It's called Phantom of the Paradise, sort of a rock and roll spin on Phantom of the Opera. And the music was done by one of the greats in my mind, Paul Williams. And the song that I picked is sort of the... Sort of the common favorite song of this movie, and kind of frames everything that happens. And so it's this song called Faust.
I was not myself last night, couldn't set things right with apologies or flowers. Out of place as a crying clown who could only frown, and the play went on for hours. And as I lived my role, I swore I'd sell my soul for one love who would stand by me.
Yeah, so, like I said, I mean, the movie's about this guy who essentially sells himself to this corrupt music agent in order to get his music sung by the woman he's in love with. And sort of, you know, it sort of parallels to this song. It's about this guy who's talking about selling his soul to have his one love sing a song. And I just think it's a beautiful song. I love the lyricism. It's got that classic 70s ballad sound to it. You know, production's amazing, and it's the one song from this movie that I go back to a lot. I mean, I could have picked like half a dozen different songs from this movie, but this is the one that I go back to the most.
Yeah, I've never seen Phantom of the Paradise, but I love Paul Williams. I mean, that voice of his, nobody else has that voice. You know it from the first few words. And he's such a talented songwriter that even a song like this, which, you know, I hadn't heard before because it's tucked away on this, you know, soundtrack, I was like, oh, this could be a hit single. Like, no doubt in my mind, because it doesn't have explicit references to the movie or the characters, really. But by my understanding, the song is in the movie is written by the main character and is inspired by the story of Faust. So you could put it out just as is, and it would totally work as this kind of, you know, desperate love song, Paul.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw this, quick aside, I saw this movie in the Majestic Theater in Dallas, which is actually the titular paradise in the movie. It was filmed in there. And so it was kind of an amazing, one of the cooler experiences I've had, where I'm watching this movie and I see the theater on the screen and I look over to the side and I see the exact part of the theater that's on the screen in real life. It was, it's just a classic movie. I can't recommend it enough.
Mm-hmm. And one of my songs later on has a Paul Williams connection as well. So
awesome.
Stay tuned for that. But all right, my first pick, I'm starting off with one of my favorite movies ever. It's in my Letterboxd favorite 4, as a matter of fact. It's Casino. I mentioned Martin Scorsese earlier. Well, here he is. And I picked one of the many, many songs in this movie. This is The Rolling Stones, originally from their Sticky Fingers album. And this is Can't You Hear Me Knockin'? That's one of my favorite Stones riffs, you know, just so much swagger. Ba-na-na-na-na. I love that. And the thing about Casino, you know, it gets a lot of obvious comparisons to Goodfellas. And one of the similarities is how quickly it changes songs. I mean, the movie zips by and it seems like every 30 seconds there's a new song playing. But Can't You Hear Me Knockin' is like 7 minutes long and they play the whole thing over a montage. Including the jazzy jam session there. They play all of it. And it's the montage of Joe Pesci and his crew, you know, shaking people down, robbing jewelry stores, opening up a restaurant. Pesci gets oral sex in a car. Slide over, honey. You know, he's marking his territory. Like in the lyrics, hear me prowling, hear me growling, hear me howling, hear me knocking. So it's the perfect song to accompany that montage, Paul.
Yeah, you know, one of the songs I was considering, I was on my short list, was Gimme Shelter, also by the Stones, and used in The Departed, famously, mm-hmm. and a bunch of other movies. But I mean, The Rolling Stones, it's almost like a cheat code to me, especially with Scorsese movies, where it makes everything seem cooler to me. Just like it's a great, you know, almost anything goes with it and just makes it seem even more awesome. And yeah, obviously it works brilliantly in this case with Casino.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we could have done a whole episode of just Scorsese. You know, I mean, there are directors who are known for their soundtracks as much as they are for their visual style, and he's one of them, you know, and we have a few others like that on this episode here, but Casino or Goodfellas alone, I mean, those are just chock full of great songs that match up with equally great scenes there, Paul, so.
For sure.
All right, what you got next, man?
All right. Next, I want to bring it to the late great David Lynch, to perhaps the most famous movie, one of my favorites of his, by Blue Velvet. And this song really really kind of kicks off the insanity in this movie for me, and that is In Dreams by Roy Orbison.
A candy-colored clown they call the Sandman tiptoes to my room every night just to sprinkle stardust and to whisper, go to sleep, everything is all right. I close my eyes, then I drift away.
So this is this song is a favorite of Dennis Hopper's character Frank in the movie. He never refers to it as In Dreams. He just calls it Candy Colored Clown. And in the middle of the movie, he tells one of his cronies play a Candy Colored Clown, and the guy starts, you know, singing it. And it's just, yeah, you see people dancing. It's just an insanity. This room of just like insanity as you know, Kyle MacLachlan's character realizes how deep he's gotten into it, and later you see Dennis Hopper start literally just like repeating the chorus back to Kyle MacLachlan's character just in the most threatening manner possible. And it takes this really, you know, kind of, I don't know, hokey, like classic love style song, and just gives it this threatening, just kind of insane spin to it. I loved it.
Yeah, I watched Blue Velvet for the first time last year, and it's not the most surreal David Lynch thing I've ever seen, but it's still rather unsettling as I huff on some gas and drink a can of Pabst Blue Ribbon. Heineken, fuck that shit! but Roy Orbison, he has that darker edge to him too, and this song, it is rather moody and down, you know, of being so heartbroken over losing someone that you just want to sleep because they're still in your dreams, but then you have to wake up. So, you know, having that song play while Dennis Hopper is beating up poor Kyle MacLachlan, it's not quite as jarring a contrast as the singing in the rain scene is in A Clockwork Orange. But it's still a rather memorable visual, as is, yeah, like you said, Dean Stockwell lip syncing to it in the apartment.
Yep.
And dreams are a recurring theme in David Lynch's work overall. You know, we are like the dreamer who dreams and then lives inside the dream. As I wiggle my fingers, you know, it's a natural fit there, Paul.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a pretty good Lynch impression.
I try. I read that Roy Orbison, he didn't like Blue Velvet at first, which is understandable, I think, but Lynch encouraged him to watch it again. Watch it again, Roy! And he changed his mind. He loved it. And it actually helped give Orbison a career resurgence there in the 80s. And Rebecca Del Rio as well did a Spanish language version of Crying in Mulholland Drive, which I just watched the other week. So yeah, Lynch and Orbison are pretty connected there overall there, Paul.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that story before. That's great to hear.
Mm-hmm. All right, my next pick, we are going to Middle Earth, to the land of hobbits and orcs and potatoes. Boil them, mash them, stick them in a stew. Howard Shore did the score for all three Lord of the Rings movies, and this is from The Return of the King, and this is The Battle of the Pelennor Fields.
We'll be right back.
So I rewatched the entire trilogy recently, the extended cut, because that's how I roll. And by the time I got to Return of the King, I was getting rather emotional at multiple scenes. I was tearing up. I had snot coming out of my nose. Like, I've seen these movies a bunch of times, but it had been a while, and it just hit me. And this is one of the scenes. King Theoden and the Rohirrim lining up to battle. You know, the ride now speed. Ride now! Ride now! Ride! Ride for ruins and the world's ending! Death! Courage, Mary. Courage for our friends. I'm getting emotional just now talking about it, you know, and the way the music builds up with the marching drums, like an advancing army, and the Rohan theme kicks in when they all charge. It floors me every single time, Paul. It always gets me.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen any of the Lord of the Rings movies. I should rewatch them. But I did rewatch this scene before, you know, for this episode. And yeah, it's great. It's it's great sound. I love the violin kind of soaring over the rest of the instruments in there as it's building up, and then you get the horns coming in. It's I mean the whole score is really beautiful and fits the battle here. So yeah, it's a good song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, you know, Howard Shore, what he was able to accomplish with his score is pretty incredible, because I can't think of many other movies that have this many iconic, like, leitmotifs, because if you ask me what the Shire theme is, I can give it to you instantly.
Right.
If you ask me what the Isengard theme is, instantly. Bump, 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 bump. Same with the Rings theme, same with the Fellowship theme, the Rohan theme, the Galadriel theme, the Mordor theme. Like, all of them are so distinct and recognizable. And with the exception of probably Star Wars, I guess, I don't know if any other series of movies can boast such a claim, Paul.
I mean, pretty much a Star Wars, right? That's the place to, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. But all right, Paul, what's your next pick?
All right, so for my next pick, we're going to go into the Coen Brothers filmography. I actually got three different Coen Brothers movies on this list because they're one of my favorites when it comes to music choices. And this first one is from one of my favorite movies by them, and it's from one of my favorite scenes in the movie, probably my favorite scene of the movie overall. And one of the reasons is because of this song, which is Danny Boy by Frank Patterson.
Danny boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen and down the mountainside. The summer's gone and all the roses falling. Tis you must go, and I must bide. But come ye back when summer's in the meadow, or when the valley's hushed.
Yeah, so this scene, this song comes on, it's put on in the movie. It's diegetic by Albert Finney's character. He plays his Irish mob boss in the movie. And he just puts it on while he's smoking a pipe. He's in his bedroom after a long day, just relaxing. And as he's listening to it, he realizes there are some men that are coming in to kill him. And so he gets ready. He's under the... He grabs his revolver, gets under his bed. And as the music crescendos, as we heard towards the end there, he starts firing. It's this firestorm. You know, he shoots a guy in the head, and it's the violence is just brutal. I mean, nobody does violence like the Coen brothers to me. The way that this guy's head explodes, and he grabs one of the guy's Tommy guns, and he starts shooting him as they come out the window, and they try to get out of the car. They have tried to escape by a car, and he shoots them, and the car crashes, and it's just this beautiful explosion of violence that is just raised even higher for me by Danny Boy, which is playing in the background the whole time.
I only know two scenes from Miller's Crossing. One of them is John Turturro begging Gabriel Byrne not to kill him in the woods.
Yeah, look into your heart, yeah.
The other is the Danny Boy scene, because how can you forget Albert Finney with a Tommy gun shooting 8,000 bullets from the street, up through a window, into another guy. His Tommy gun is going off as he's being riddled with bullets. He shoots through his own foot. Albert Finney keeps firing at the car and never reloads. Nobody ever reloads in that scene. They just keep firing thousands of bullets, apparently, while Danny Boy's playing. It's again, much like within Dreams or Singing in the Rain, it's the contrast of this beautiful classic Irish song and just the most cartoonish violence. I mean, it's a cartoon. I mean, Raising Arizona is a live action Looney Tunes, but this as well is so over the top, Paul.
Yeah, for sure. Raising Arizona, that's another one. So many. Yeah, I mean, nobody does like cartoonish. I don't know. They make like the most. They're like almost like simultaneously like cartoonish and grounded in most of their movies. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard that theory that the Coen brothers make they make one type of movie as a drama and then they make the same movie as a comedy and they just go back and forth like that?
I haven't. No.
Okay. Well, they deal with, you know, very similar themes throughout their movies, and mm-hmm. just with a different spin on it every time, either comedic or tragic and so forth. But mm-hmm. anyway, yeah.
Well, I do know that they're able to go back and forth between serious and comedy with their movies. Like, you know, Fargo is a crime movie that has plenty of comedy in it. No Country for Old Men is also a crime movie with very little comedy in that. Not a lot of laughs in that one.
It has a few moments, though, honestly. I think
it's a little not like Fargo, though.
Sure.
But yeah, and like you said, you've got other Coen brothers coming up later on, which I'm fine with, because they've got a lot of, you know, classic songs in their oeuvre, like Scorsese does. So we'll get to them again later on. But all right, my next pick, we go from Danny Boy to a group of boys from the ghetto. It's Ghetto Boys, and they're on the soundtrack to another cult classic movie. It's Office Space, and this is the Ghetto Boys song, Still.
Back up in your ass with the resurrection. Is the group harder than an erection that shows no affection? They want to ban us on Capitol Hill, cause it's die, motherfuckers, die, motherfuckers.
All along it was a ghetto, nothing but the ghetto. Taking short steps, one foot at a time, and kept my head low and never let go. Cause if I let go, then I'll be spineless. I'm going insane.
I think my mind just goes out of control and touch on subjects motherfuckers read about. I touch on the shit that they be leaving out. I seen this motherfucker's non-smoking. I seen the same nigga with the nine dying with his eyes open. And simply what this means is he didn't know that every dog had his day until he seen his. I bet you motherfuckers will too, because it's time, motherfucker, die, motherfucker, steal, fool.
So I have little knowledge of the Ghetto Boys. I know Bushwick Bill got shot in the eye, and he's no longer with us, sadly. But everything else I know about them comes from their songs being used in Office Space. One of them is Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangster. But this song was in probably the most iconic scene in the movie, the printer scene, where they take the printer that keeps, you know, screwing up. PC lowlighter, what the fuck does that mean? And they take it out to a field and they just destroy it with a baseball bat. Dave Herman just starts punching it, you know, at one point. And the whole time we're hearing die, motherfuckers, you know. So it's funny, but it's also kind of cathartic. And the whole soundtrack is gangster rap. So there is that juxtaposition with, you know, white collar office culture throughout the whole movie there, Paul.
Right, yeah, for sure. I was going to say, Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangster, that's probably my favorite song used in the movie. But this is also very, very good, obviously, and I love the... it's very funny, the contrast, you know, this song that's, you know, shouting, like, die, motherfucker, die, as they're assaulting a faulty printer, and just the contrast there is inherently funny. And, yeah, it's one of the better scenes in the movie. I have... I used to watch this movie... like all the time as a kid. I don't know if you had a similar experience growing up, but for whatever reason, I feel like every weekend they would play this movie on Comedy Central, and so I must have seen it like a dozen times. But yeah, it's a classic.
Yeah, I've seen it a bunch over the years. I mean, you look at the cast alone. I mean, that is such a hey, it's that guy all-star game. You got sure. Stephen Root, Gary Cole, John C. McGinley, Richard Reel, Diedrich Bader, two chicks at the same time, man. Just such a great lineup, and I'm glad that this movie has such an endearing cultural impact, because it wasn't a box office hit by a long stretch, but with the home video sales and all the memes that are out there, and it's so quotable. Like, even if you haven't seen Office Space, chances are you've still absorbed it in some way, Paul.
Yeah, that and Idiocracy, two box office bombs that went on to become huge cult hits.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Paul, what you got next?
All right, so my next pick comes from one of my favorite movies of all time, and was definitely the movie I watched the most and identified with the most as a teenager. It is the second movie of director Wes Anderson. It's a movie called Rushmore, and for me, this is the greatest needle drop in movie history, or it's my favorite at least, and it comes right at the very end of the movie. This is Ooh La La by Faces.
For old Granddad, I laughed at all his words. I thought he was a bitter man. He spoke of women's ways. They trap you and they use you before you even know. For love is blind and you're far too kind. Don't ever let. I wish that I knew what I know now. When I was younger, I wish that I knew what I know now. When I was stronger, the can-can such a free show to steal your heart away. The backstage back on earth again. The dressing rooms are great. They come on strong and it ain't too long, but I make you feel.
Yes, so this comes on at the very end of the movie after the Max, the protagonist Max, just put on his play and their little after party afterwards. And this comes on as he asks his teacher that he's had this infatuation with the whole movie to dance, and they dance, and this song comes on as the credits start rolling, and it's just such a beautiful catharsis to me. This song, it really sums up kind of the Max's arc throughout the movie, talking about I wish I knew now. I wish I knew then what I know now. And it's, you know, talking about, you know, struggling to deal with women and stuff. And by the end of the movie, you know, he's managed to patch up his relationship with his teacher, even though obviously they're not going to be romantically together. And it just, I don't know. It just sums up the movie, beautifully for me. And, yeah, I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We played this one on one of the first episodes of the remix format way back when.
Oh, okay.
It was the Card Subject to Change episode, because it's not Rod Stewart or Ron Lane singing, it's Ron Wood. And this is one of my favorite Faces songs, actually. I actually discovered it from watching Rushmore for the first time. And you're right, it is a perfect choice, because Jason Schwartzman is such a little shitbag in that movie. You know, he thinks he's the man, he's trying to get with Olivia Williams, you know, but as the movie goes on, he grows up a little bit, he makes some changes, becomes a better person. You know, it's a classic story arc. And I'd say of the Wes Anderson movies I've seen, Rushmore is my favorite, because it's before he really went into the deep end of the pool, shall we say, style-wise. But that's just me. But yeah, Rushmore or not, this song is fantastic, Paul.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. This is still my favorite Wes Anderson movie, and I like his movies now, but I do agree he can be a little much at times. His period when he was writing, he was co-writing with Owen Wilson. I think that was really his peak, and this was right in there. Him and Owen wrote this one.
Mm-hmm. And if I had to pick another song from the soundtrack, actually, Making Time by The Creation is a really good song. It's also got Here Comes My Baby by Cat Stevens.
Yeah. Oh, Yoko. Tons of good ones.
Yeah. Nothing in the World Could Stop Me Worrying About That Girl by The Kinks. Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo produced it. So, yeah, it's a good soundtrack overall there, for sure. But all right. My next pick, I had to pick a Bond theme. It was a given for me. And I went with one from the Roger Moore era. This is from The Spy Who Loved Me. It's a song composed by Marvin Hamlisch and sung by Carly Simon. This is Nobody Does It Better. One of a handful of Bond themes where the song does not have the same name as the movie. The Spy Who Loved Me is in the lyrics, but not the title, which is a fun fact there. But I love that song. That's one of my favorite Bond themes. I love when it goes from her singing with just the piano in the beginning there, and then the drums and strings come crashing in. Boom, I wasn't looking, but somehow you found me. It's funny, it's a Bond theme that doesn't really feel like a Bond theme. It doesn't have that cinematic element of intrigue and danger and death that a lot of other Bond themes have. It's just a heartfelt love song that could have just been another hit single, but it's tied to Bond, Paul.
Yeah, I gotta be honest. James Bond's a pretty big blind spot for me in my cinematic repertoire. I've seen a few of the Pierce Brosnan movies and a few of the Daniel Craig movies, but anything before that is pretty much totally I haven't seen yet. So, but I was going to say, I did watch the opening of this and to listen to the song, and I was going to say what you said, is that, yeah, it doesn't sound like the traditional Bond theme to me, but yeah, it's very good. I mean, I love Carly Simon. It works. It's a great song. I was a little surprised you didn't pick Another Way to Die, the classic Bond theme from Quantum of Solace. You love that one, right?
I actually played that one on a previous episode. It was the Parejas Increíbles episode, because it was, you know, Jack White and Alicia Keys, two, you know, different artists coming together on a song there. But I actually do kind of like that song. I also could have picked You Know My Name by Chris Cornell. I think that's that may be my all-time favorite theme.
Yeah,
Bond theme. I
need to emphasize, I was being a little sarcastic personally. I really hate that Another Way to Die song.
I gotcha.
But You Know My Name, that's probably my favorite of the Bond songs that I've heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Roger Moore, he didn't have the best Bond movies, but he did have three of the best Bond themes. This, Live and Let Die, and A View to a Kill. Those are all top-tier themes.
Yeah, Live and Let Die. Yeah, Live and Let Die is very good. I haven't heard the other one.
Yeah. And when Desmond Llewellyn, who played Q for many, many, many films, died in 99, and then when Roger Moore died years later, they put out these tribute videos to them, And the song they used in both of them was Nobody Does It Better. Because it works so well as a tribute song.
Nice.
All right, Paul, what's your next pick?
All right, so I felt the need to include a little international flavor in my list here because I'm a massive lover of Asian cinema. And so I went with one of my favorite musical pieces. It's sort of a running motif in this movie. It's it's called Yumeji's Theme, and it was originally used in the film called Yumeji, which is a great Japanese film. But the song didn't realize its full potential until it was used in the Wong Kar-wai movie In the Mood for Love. So this is the song. So it's this song that's used almost constantly throughout In the Mood for Love. It just keeps reoccurring as the two main characters who are they're married to other people, and their respective spouses are having an affair behind their backs, and so they start spending more time. And you keep hearing the song continue as their sort of their own relationship develops, and you know it's this beautiful kind of waltz tempo, very kind of light but like mournful. You've got that beautiful violin, just you know, so sorry sounding, and it just really captures longing. Like this is like longing the movie to me, and this is also like the song is also like just personified longing as sound. I feel like if this was on and you could look at almost anyone and you would just think like, wow, like why am I not like with this person? Just it's such a beautifully emotional song to me, and that's why I wanted to highlight it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know there are examples of composers reusing scores in different movies or having some very similar scores in their movies, but I can't think of other examples of something like this where you have one movie taking a piece of score from another movie. Mm-hmm. And it's different composers, it's different, you know, film scenes, China and Japan. I mean, it works for this movie because, yeah, it's you know, it fits the romantic vibes, but it is still odd to see the subtitle theme for In the Mood for Love when the title is literally Yumeji's Theme. The movie is Yumeji. It's Yumeji's Theme. Sure. And not anymore. Sorry about that. but yeah, it's again, it fits the whole romantic vibes of the movie there, Paul, for sure.
Yep.
But I haven't seen the movie actually. I need to watch it. I've heard all the praise. I'll get around to it. I promise. It's on my watch list on Letterboxd, so I'll get to it eventually, Paul. I promise.
Yeah, Wong Kar-wai. I'd recommend a lot of his movies. Another guy who's really expert at using music. Another movie that I was considering for this this list is a movie called Chungking Express, which is actually my personal favorite movie of his. But those two, I would say, are must see.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we played Paul Williams earlier. Well, he did a song called Touch with my next pick, Daft Punk,
right,
on their album Random Access Memories. And Daft Punk did the soundtrack for this movie, Tron Legacy. And I went with the end credits song. It's simply called Tron Legacy. So there are cases where the soundtrack is better than the movie. And this is one of those cases. I mean, I do actually like Tron Legacy. I do have a soft spot for that movie. But the soundtrack is the clear highlight of the whole thing for me. And they got the perfect group to do it. I mean, what better choice for a movie that takes place inside a computer than a pair of robots, you know? And it's a blend of the electronic music of Daft Punk and also orchestral music by Joseph Trapanese. And you can hear that in the end credits song. It starts off with and then the main theme comes in. And then at the end of the song, it's just the orchestra coming in to do the main theme. So, you know, I don't listen to a lot of movie scores on their own, but I definitely listen to this one, Paul, because I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, this is probably the most remembered aspect of Tron Legacy is the soundtrack. I do like Tron Legacy also, actually. But yeah, this is, yeah, the whole soundtrack's great. I mean, one of the, yeah, I like Daft Punk, and they knocked out of the park capturing, you know, the feel of this movie, obviously. did you see Tron Ares? I know Trent Reznor tried to recreate the sound, I imagine. I don't know how, I haven't heard any of it, so I don't know how well of a job he did.
I didn't see the movie. I did listen to the soundtrack, though, because, yeah, Nine Inch Nails is doing it, and that's another good pick, because Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross have done a lot of great scores. And they can also certainly handle electronic music, for sure. And I like a few of the songs on there, but it didn't grab me like the Tron Legacy soundtrack does, Paul.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. That might be my favorite Daft Punk song, Touch, by Paul Williams. So
it's great. Yeah. I played on this show again last year, so it's really great. But all right, Paul, what's your next pick there?
Okay, so we're taking our second dive into the Coen Brothers filmography here with another one of my favorite movies by them. A little underrated in my opinion, because I think it's like, you know, one of their top three, top five movies at least. It's Inside Llewyn Davis, which I could have, again, I could have picked like half a dozen different songs from this movie. It's almost a musical because it's about the New York folk scene in the early 60s. But the song that I went with is just one of my favorite fake songs of all time. It's one of the funniest, movie songs ever made. And it's, yeah, I listen to it all the time. It gets stuck in my head all the time. Anyway, let's play it. It's called Please, Mr. Kennedy.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4.
1 second, please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I don't want to go.
Don't show me in the outer space.
Oh, please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I don't want to go.
Don't show me in the outer space.
I sweat when they stuff me in the pressure suits. Rubble helmet, flash, board, and boots. Nowhere to fit in gravity
space.
I need to breathe.
Outer.
Don't need to be a
space.
Reading me loud and clear. Roll, please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I don't want to go.
Please don't show me in the outer space.
Oh, please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I don't want to go.
Please don't show me in the outer space.
I'm 6'2", so perhaps you'll tell me how I'm fit into a five-year capsule. I won't be known as man of the century if I'm good.
Yeah, so in the context of the movie, this is a song that Justin Timberlake's character kind of wrote and put together in his recording, and he's helping out Llewyn Davis, the main character played by Oscar Isaac. He's helping him out by letting him do a backup voice and guitar on the song, and it really highlights just what a miserable asshole Llewyn Davis is, because he's like, who wrote this? He thinks the song sucks, and it's not. He doesn't even realize that it's going to be a hit, even though it's just you know, it's kind of a goofy, dumb song, but it's so like impossibly catchy and just funny that it's hard not to get into. And you've got Adam Driver in the scene. It's still one of my favorite Adam Driver roles because he's just such a weirdo in this scene, doing his little like outer space. He's just doing the funniest thing with his voice the whole song. And a funny thing about this song too that I found out is apparently Justin Timberlake actually did largely help compose this song, which kind of makes me like Justin Timberlake a little more. But yeah, it's one of my favorite songs from the movie.
Well, I hate you, Paul. Do you know how many times I've said, uh-oh, in the past week? It's a lot.
Oh, yeah. It's catchy.
Outer space. Outer space. But yeah, this is a damn delight. Like, it has the right amount of catchiness and cheese to where it could be an actual novelty song. And yeah, the scene where they record it is, it's even funnier than the song. Because, yeah, Oscar Isaac asks Timberlake, who wrote this? And the way Timberlake's face drops when he goes, I did. And then, you know, keep your eye on Adam Driver the whole time, because his head movements and the faces he makes when he's doing his vocals are just hysterical.
Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to mention, I love the lyrics. It's, I love a good rhyme, and rhyming perhaps you'll with capsule just had me dying. I think it's so funny. Yeah, great song.
Yeah. I'm just picturing the Disney exec who watched this movie and said, hey, you know that guy who says, uh-oh, 1 second, please, shout? He's going to be the villain in our new Star Wars trilogy. That tall, gangly guy from Girls, that's our new big bad guy. So I just... yeah. It's quite the, yeah.
Him and Poe Dameron both get cast in the Star Wars movies.
Yeah. All right, now for something completely different. This is an animated movie for the young kids out there. And really, when I think of kids, the first thing I think of is Motorhead. they re-recorded a song of theirs called You Better Run for the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. They remade this song, and it's called You Better Swim.
I got no reason to be paranoid. What's on the hook? That's what I avoid. I was born underwater without a sound. The muffins and the drink. All around, you better swim. Baby, you better swim. I gotta slide like a tiger shark. Now I'm gonna do you in. I'm short and I'm tall. I'm black and I'm white. Sometimes I'll be wrong, sometimes I'll be right. I'm iron and steel, and I'm bad to the bone.
Again, a perfect choice, because there's a scene where SpongeBob and Patrick go to a rough and tumble bar, and the music that's playing in the bar is Motorhead. And I love it for two reasons. One, I love that Lemmy changed the lyrics to make them ocean themed. So now he's singing things like, I'm talking at pictures and I'm painting them black. I'm telling you, fish face, you ain't never coming back. I mean, that's a tremendous line right there. And two, you know, even though it's SpongeBob, it's still Motorhead. Like, they go hard. I mean, this is a hard blues metal song. And they treat this no different than they would with a song on one of their own albums or with a Triple H theme or whatever. So, yeah, Motorhead, you know, give it all they got for SpongeBob SquarePants, Paul.
Yeah, I was a massive SpongeBob fan growing up. I watched it every morning before school, and I saw this in theaters when I must have been 10 years old with my dad, and I loved it. And the I loved the music so much, too. I actually had the CD, the soundtrack for the movie on CD. Mm. This wasn't one of the songs I played a lot. I was very partial to Ocean Man by Ween. That's probably my favorite song from the movie, but yeah, I mean, this is a good song, and it's very funny, as you're saying, how they I like the Motorhead and Lemmy were willing to play along and make this ocean themed for their kids movie that they did this for.
Yeah, the soundtrack as a whole is a fun mix because the creator of the show, Steven Hillenburg, he didn't want a whole bunch of big name commercial artists of the day on the soundtrack. He wanted it to be reflective of his own tastes.
Right.
So you got Motorhead, you got the Flaming Lips, you got Wilco, the Shins, Ocean Man by Ween, as you said, is on there. So it's as quirky as those first three seasons of the show were, Paul, definitely.
Yeah, now you got, Ice Spice, I think, was in the news movie or something?
I don't know. I've aged out of SpongeBob a long time ago, so yeah. it's all passed me by. But I still have a big fondness for those first few seasons. They're ingrained in my DNA at this point, so. Oh,
absolutely. Yeah, me too.
Yeah. But all right, what's your next pick, Paul?
All right, so we're going into the last Coen Brothers movie on my list, which is another one of my favorite movies growing up, called The Big Lebowski. Maybe my favorite comedy of all time. And the song I picked, there's the soundtrack as a whole, another great soundtrack. But I decided to go with the very last song that you hear in the movie. One of my favorite cover songs of all time, actually. It was originally a Rolling Stones song. But this is Towns Van Zandt's cover, and it's Dead Flowers.
Well, I hope you don't see me in my ragged company. All that you know, I could never be alone. Take me down, little Susie, take me down. I know you think you're the queen of the underground. Send me dead flowers every morning. Send me dead flowers by the maid. Send me dead flowers to my wedding. I won't forget to put roses on your grave.
Yeah, so, you know, no disrespect to the Stones. I've heard the original. I think this version just is so much better. I love Towns Van Zandt's interpretation of it here. And the way it works in the movie, I mean, it's got kind of, you know, it's the dude has quite the odyssey in this movie. And to me, this is just the perfect way to just kind of unwind at the end of this crazy, chaotic movie. We've got this very calming, kind of melancholy Towns Van Zandt song. That almost sounds like it sounds like it was recorded in a bar or something, which is fitting since he's at the bar in the bowling alley at the end. And it's just a great bow tie on this this classic film for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we technically get more Stones. Because they did the original, like you said, and we get more Jeff Bridges here. First it was Tron, Biodigital Jazz Man, and right. Now it's the dude. New shit has come to light. you know, for a movie that is so eccentric and weird and funny, it does end on such a sad, contemplative song. I mean, Van Zandt really strips it down and rings out the emotion on this one. Until the dude and the stranger start talking and. Then it goes into the background there, but that monologue that Sam Elliott gives, the dude abides, I take comfort in that. I could listen to that all day. I mean, his voice is like silk and butter combined. So,
sure.
Yeah, Big Lebowski, again, one of those movies where if you haven't seen it, you've probably absorbed it in some way because of the memes and because of the various scenes that have been, you know, shared around, you know, the interwebs over the years, I guess, Paul. So,
yeah, I've probably seen it like a couple dozen times. There's a period in my life where I would watch this like literally like once a month, and I would make So I wasn't 21 yet. I was in like middle school, and I would like pour chocolate milk into a glass and put ice cubes in the glass as if it was a White Russian. And I've since had White Russians, of course, which they're pretty good themselves, but don't often buy Kahlua.
Mm-hmm. They're calling the cops, man. Put the piece away. yeah, the difference between you and me is I would have gone with Just Dropped In. I would have gone with the obvious pick there. Great. I also probably would have picked the Gypsy Kings version of Hotel California, because unlike the dude, I don't hate the fucking Eagles, man. I actually like them, so, but yeah, great stuff there. Great way to wrap up the Coen Brothers little trilogy on this episode, for sure. All right, my next pick, speaking of obvious choices, this is one of the more obvious choices to make. I went with Mr. Ennio Morricone, the godfather of Western music, and this is arguably his most famous piece, or one of them. It's from Sergio Leone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and this is The Ecstasy of Gold. Great. You know, I wonder how many people know that song but don't know the actual scene it's in. Because the movie is about these three guys trying to find this buried treasure, this buried Confederate gold. And it's in this grave in a cemetery. And you might think this song plays to this, you know, climactic showdown between the gunslingers or Clint Eastwood on a horse, you know, riding full speed into danger. But no, the scene is Tuco, the ugly, running through the cemetery looking for the grave. And he keeps running around, and that's it. But man, the buildup of this song as it goes, you know, more and more animated, you got the choir and the horns and the strings going, and it builds to this fever pitch, and the camera starts spinning around all these headstones. It gives you chills. I mean, even out of the context of the movie, it still gives you chills. I mean, 60 years later, it's such an effective and moving piece of music, Paul.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you could have picked, you know, a dozen different Ennio Morricone pieces. But yeah, this is incredible. Obviously, I love the way it builds. You're right, just the way it gradually. It amps you up. You know, you get into it, and just that's what Morricone is so good at, all his music. You know, I personally would have picked probably something from For a Few Dollars More. That's my favorite movie of the trilogy. I love the dynamic of Lee Van Cleef and Clint Eastwood working together as a team, and obviously the music's incredible in that as well. But yeah, this is a great pick. It's an iconic song from a classic movie.
Mm-hmm. What's funny is, you know, Morricone's score is so good, but the other audio in the movie is so janky because it's all dubbed over.
Yeah,
because Italian cinema back then, it wasn't the norm to record synchronous audio with the video. Mm-hmm. It would be dubbed over in post. So yeah, you've got actors from different countries speaking their own languages and then being dubbed into English or Italian or whatever, depending on the market. And it's very noticeable. Like, the dialogue isn't matching the lips in several cases. So you have a movie like this, which is considered one of the greatest Westerns of all time, and it still has its peculiarities of the era, Paul.
Yeah, they did not have any microphones on set ever, which once you find that out, it's very obvious, and it's kind of, yeah, you mean, you can't not notice it. It's interesting quirk to the movie.
Mm-hmm. All right, what you got next, Paul?
All right, so we've had some of my guys so far. We've got David Lynch, the Coen Brothers, Wes Anderson. We're going to get to another one of my guys now, which is Paul Thomas Anderson, one of his earlier movies, and possibly still my favorite movie of his. It's called Magnolia, and this is from one of the more iconic scenes in the movie, where pretty much the whole cast sings along to the song. It's by Amy Mann. It's called Wise Up.
It's not what you thought when you first began.
So this comes towards the end of the movie. You know, for those who aren't aware, Magnolia is sort of an ensemble piece following several different characters who either tangentially and directly or directly are connected with the other characters. And this hits a point in the movie where pretty much every character is at their lowest at that point. And this song comes on and it cuts between all the characters and they're all just singing along to this song. And I could, it's really a testament to the talent of Paul Thomas Anderson, because I could think of a dozen ways that this would be awful, like really terrible, but he does it so well that, you know, you feel the, you get hooked into the song too. And it just, it works. It's just this beautiful emotional moment in the movie.
You're really bumming me out here, Paul, with some of these choices. but no, this is a beautiful song. It's not what you thought when you first began it. You got what you want. Now you can hardly stand it. I mean, it's such a relatable sentiment.
Sure.
I've only seen Magnolia once, and it was years ago. So I forgot how the song appears in the movie. So yeah, I was taken aback a little bit to, you know, load up the YouTube clip and see, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman singing it. And
yeah,
Julianne Moore and Tom Cruise and Philip Baker Hall and William H. Macy and all the rest of the characters there singing the song. But when you have a movie about these people who are alone and looking for a connection, and this is how they connect, you know, when they're singing, they're alone, except for Phyllis Seymour Hoffman and Jason Robards, but the song is what brings them all together. It's how they connect in this way. So, right. It's what we in show business call metaphor, Paul. yeah, it's a very unique way to, put the song in the movie there, Paul.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you're looking for a Tom Cruise performance that is very un-Tom Cruise-y, it's this movie. Frank T.J. Mackey is not a charming, romantic, good guy, nor is he an action hero. He's a pickup artist who is basically a manosphere guy before the manosphere. And he does some real capital A acting in this thing. When he's at his dad's bedside and he's crying his eyes out. I mean, that is like, please give me an Oscar nom. Please, please, please. I mean, that is so very strong acting performance from Tom Cruise there. So
And he should have gotten it. I this might be his best performance, mainly because it really, I mean, it really leans into that kind of like that psychopathic side of Tom Cruise that we see in some interviews with him where he's just, yeah, it's an unhinged performance that you rarely see from him a role like this, mm-hmm. particularly that scene of him with his father in the movie, which I don't know if you know the history of Tom Cruise and his real father, but that came from a very real place for him. I think he came up with a lot of that scene himself. So it's a great scene.
Mm-hmm. And Cruise is going to be in that Iñárritu movie Digger coming out this year, which looks to be, you know, a very un-Tom Cruise-y role. Perhaps so.
Especially after he's been like Mr. Blockbuster for like the last like 10 years. Yeah, I'm very interested to see them.
He's Mr. Mission Impossible, basically, or Mr. Top Gun for the past decade. Yeah, but going to be interesting. But all right, this is another song from the 60s on my list, but it was used as the theme for a movie in the 90s, which is fitting because Austin Powers is about a guy from the 60s being transplanted into the 90s. So let's hear the Austin Powers theme. This is Quincy Jones and his orchestra. It's Soul Bossa Nova. Yeah, Soul Bossa Nova. The song is as advertised right there on the tin. It's cheeky, it's goofy, it's fun, it's full of pep and a bit of sexual dynamism, and it's from the 60s. So yeah, as far as Austin Powers themes go, it's a pretty damn great matchup. And it always makes me smile, too. Like, as soon as I hear that song kick in, that ooh-eh, and the piano, I'm in a good mood. And that's true for the Austin Powers movies, too. I've seen those movies a bajillion times. I know all the jokes inside and out, but you put on the Dr. Evil family therapy scene where he's explaining his childhood. You know, my father would womanize, he would drink, he would make outlandish claims like he invented the question mark. Like, I'm done. You got me. So yeah, just a little bit of levity for the episode here, Paul.
I gotcha. Yeah, I haven't seen an Austin Powers movie in literally like probably 20 years. I remembered enjoying the first couple, but I don't think I ever realized that this wasn't a song made for the Austin Powers movie. I don't know. It seems so perfect for the, you know, obviously it sounds like, you know, I think goofy James Bond movie, and this song just like perfectly captures that. So yeah, I mean, that's very well done job by whoever making the movie had the idea to pick this song out for it, because it pairs perfectly.
Mm-hmm. I looked up why they picked it. There was this radio DJ who was a music consultant on the first movie, and he suggested this song to Mike Myers. And Mike Myers liked this song so much, he rewrote the start of the movie to be like the opening of A Hard Day's Night, where he's being chased around London. And there was also this Canadian game show back in the day called Definition, which used Soul Bossa Nova as the theme, and Mike Myers watched the show as a kid. It was like this, you know, bit of kismet there, Paul. So.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. All right, what is your next pick there?
Okay, so we're going back to some Asian cinema, to Japanese cinema. Interesting note, this is a song from a Seijun Suzuki movie, one of my favorite Japanese directors, who directed Yumeji, which is what one of my previous song Yumeji themes from. But this is a movie that he made in the 60s called Tokyo Drifter. And this is the theme for that movie that is actually sung by the main character. It's by Hajime Kaburagi, and it is also called Tokyo Drifter. で生きても流れ物どうせさすらい一人身の明日はどこやら風に聞けかわいいあの子の胸に聞けあ東京流れ物 流れ果てない旅に出ていつか忘れた東京の
泣いてくれるな夜の雨。男命は赤く散る。あ、東京流れ
物。Yeah, so this song is used both diegetically and non-diegetically. It is a song being sung by the titular Tokyo Drifter in the movie as his own theme, which is just very charming to me. I love that this, you know, he's kind of portrayed as like this kind of badass, you know, action star in the movie. He's literally drifting around Tokyo, and he just has this kind of melancholy, kind of moody song. And I don't know if you look up the English lyrics, but it really sums up his character, talking about things like, if I have to perish, I'm going to be a manly flower. I abandoned my love for the sake of my duty. Yeah, just one of my favorite kind of movie theme songs for me.
Yeah, just a friendly reminder, there's a big difference between Tokyo Drifter and Tokyo Drift.
Yes.
So if you're expecting the Yin-Yang Twins, you're sorely mistaken. But this song has a little more emotional weight to it than the Tokyo Drift song does. I also put it through a translator. This is the Deep L translation, so it might be different than yours. But wherever I live, I'm a drifting soul, wandering alone, lost in the flow. Tomorrow, where will I be? Listen to the wind. Listen to the heart of that lovely girl. Ah, Tokyo, drifting soul. Mm-hmm. Setting out on a journey with no end. One day, the forgotten Tokyo. The night rain that makes me cry. A man's life blooms crimson. Ah, Tokyo, drifting soul. So, yeah, it's very poetic, Paul.
Yeah, really fun, kind of very colorful kind of Japanese action movie from the 60s. That was sort of the era of the Japanese New Wave, when they were really breaking boundaries over there. And there's some movies you can tell within five, you know, you see it like the first 5 minutes of it and you think, oh, Quentin Tarantino fucking loves this movie. And this is this is one of those movies for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the leading actor, Tetsuya Watare, he put out albums and did his own version of the song. And he was also a voice in a bunch of the Yakuza games, apparently. So, a little fun fact for you folks out there. So,
yeah.
While you said his name there, Paul, and you have summoned him to this episode, we can't leave out Quentin Tarantino, the man who loves feet, hates Paul Dano. I went with another one of my all-time favorite movies. This is from Kill Bill Volume 1, and it's a group called Santa Esmeralda, with their version of Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. That song plays at the climax of the movie as the bride and Oren Ishii, no relation to Big Tom, by the way, are having their sword fight in the snow. And you don't hear any of the vocals, it's just the music, but man, when that Latin beat is drumming, bum, 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 and the horns are going, ba-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da, and you're waiting to see if Uma Thurman can actually beat Lucy Liu after she's already fought, you know, dozens of henchmen in the club there. It's so dramatic and so exciting. And it's this, what, Latin disco song from the 70s? You know, it's not the first choice for a big samurai sword showdown, but it works. And It's funny, the full version of this song is like 16 minutes long, and thankfully Quentin didn't go the whole way through with that one. He didn't play the whole thing. That would have been a little bit too much even for him. But yeah, I, you know, whenever this scene plays, it just gets me going, Paul.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say, is when I think of a dramatic final samurai battle, I don't think of this Spanish dance song that we have here. But it's a great song. Yeah, it hypes you up. It gets you ready to watch this thing. I love the clapping and the horns. It all works. It meshes. It, you know, much like Tarantino, it kind of takes these different ingredients from different eras, different, you know, locales, and combines them to make something awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kill Bill Volume 1, it was my first Tarantino movie. I saw it on DVD when I was 11. Maybe a little too young, perhaps. I don't know. But to this day, it's one of my favorite movies ever. I don't care if you've ripped off Lady Snowblood. I don't care. This movie has Uma Thurman in a yellow jumpsuit fighting a Japanese schoolgirl with a meteor hammer and then slicing up dozens of henchmen. You know, it's got Sonny Chiba as a sword maker. If on your journey you should encounter God, God will be cut. It's the coolest. And I love Volume 2 as well. But Volume 1 got me as like a young, you know, impressionable young lad. And it's kept me ever since, Paul.
Yeah, I think I'd seen Pulp Fiction. I saw my dad and my brother showed me Pulp Fiction when I was like 6 years old. So that was the first one I saw. But I watched Kill Bill Volume 1. I was maybe around your age, maybe 10, but I saw the Spike TV version. And so I didn't see the actual version for years. And so for years, I thought the line was actually, "My name is Buck and I like to party." And then he'd drive the party wagon.
The party wagon. Yeah. 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 Different word in the theatrical cut there. So
yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. But yeah, just an awesome damn movie. I mean, I know Quentin is, ruffle some feathers in recent weeks with his comments there, but the man can make a movie, goddammit. He can make some damn fine absolute cinema, in my opinion. So
sure,
I'll give him a pass in this case. But all right, Paul, what is your last pick of the episode?
All right, so for my last pick, I thought I've got to fit my all-time favorite movie into this list somehow, and that my all-time favorite movie is Michael Mann's Heat with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. And I thought, God, what would be the perfect song? And then it hit me. The perfect song is the final one that happens over the closing scene of the movie. And just really, you know, it just really ties everything together. It's a song by Moby. It's called God Moving Over the Face of the Waters. So, you know, that song comes at the end of basically 3 hours of following our two main characters, Neil McCauley, played by Robert De Niro, and Vincent Hanna, the detective, played by Al Pacino. And they're barely seen together at all in the movie. And it's not until the final shot of the movie is you finally see them together in the same shot, as they're clasping hands, and they're almost like soulmates in a way. You know, they both are just solely devoted to doing what they do. You know, Robert De Niro does what he does best. He takes scores. Al Pacino does what he does best, tries to catch guys like him. They're almost like soulmates in a way, but cursed to constantly being on opposite sides of the law, constantly chasing after each other. And so, you know, you've got this final moment where Robert De Niro says, you know, I told you I'm never going back. And Al Pacino's like, yeah. And there's this moment of understanding and compassion as Al Pacino holds De Niro's hand as he's dying. And it cuts to the final shot, and the horns start soaring over this beautiful song in the background. I love the recurring piano motif. It's just, and every time when that climax hits, it just, I start tearing up. It's just so emotional, and this song is a big part of that. I just think it's a beautiful song.
Mm-hmm. See, if I was going to pick a Moby song, it would have been Extreme Ways from the Jason Bourne movies. Because that song plays at the end of all of those movies, but this is the more classic cinematic song. I mean, with the sweeping strings and the piano trills and all that, it's epic without being really bombastic and triumphant. And that's appropriate because, yeah, we just spent 3 hours following both Pacino and De Niro's characters, and we're kind of rooting for both of them. But at the final shootout, someone has to win, someone has to lose. There's no double DQ here. You know, there's no contest.
Yeah.
So when, spoiler alert, Pacino kills De Niro, it's a big climactic moment, but not necessarily a happy one.
Paul. Right.
And I'll say this, though. My goal of the show is not to be a hot take zone. It's meant to be a fun hang. But I have to be honest here. I think Heat is pretty good. I don't love it. I understand why it's like a guy's movie Hall of Famer for a lot of people. I understand that. It just doesn't grab me in that way. If I'm going Michael Mann crime thriller, I prefer Collateral. That's the one I really love. And that's another non-Tom Cruise, Tom Cruise role.
Oh,
he's
sure.
Fantastic in that. But again, I like Heat. I'm not saying I don't like it. I don't have it in that upper echelon tier for me, like you do, Paul.
I adore Collateral too. I think it's another one of Tom Cruise's best performances. I do have Heat slightly above Collateral, but they're both all-timers. I will say, I think if you ever get the opportunity to see Heat in a movie theater, I think it may grab you a little more just because
I will say that. Yeah, that is, you know, I'm watching on my laptop and it's a big difference watching that shootout in the streets on a laptop versus on some giant cinema screen. I'm sure it is, you know.
I'm telling those gunshots were meant to be heard in a theater. I mean, it really gets your ears ringing. It's amazing. Just the cinematic, it's such a, yeah, it was a movie made to be seen on as big and loud as a format as possible.
True. Yeah. But, all right, my last pick. This is another cover, probably one of the most famous covers of all time, I think, next to Hurt by Johnny Cash or Hendrix doing Watchtower. This song is originally done by Tears for Fears, but for the movie Donnie Darko, which I rewatched today, actually, Michael Andrews did his own version of the song with Gary Jules on vocals. So let's hear their version of Mad World.
Their tears are filling up their glasses. No expression, no expression. Hide my head, I wanna drown my sorrow. No tomorrow, no tomorrow. And I find it kinda funny, I find it kinda sad. Dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad world. Mad world. Children waiting for the day they
So how do you make a famously melancholic song by Tears for Fears even sadder? You strip it right down to just a bit of piano, a mellotron, and a vocoder. And you get Gary Jules with the most sad boy vocals in the world. It's so depressing. But for a song that is so stripped down musically, it still carries so much emotional weight, even more so than the Tears for Fears version, because there aren't all of these synths and other bits and bobs, you know, in the way. It's just the most basic form of the song. And you talk about a song matching the vibe of a movie. Here's Exhibit A, man. I mean, Donnie Darko, not what you would call a laugh riot. It's not It's a Mad, 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 Mad World by any stretch. This is a dour and moody film. So the sadder the song, the better, I think, Paul.
Yeah. I will say, since you just said it with heat, Donnie Darko, you know, it's pretty good. I've never loved it like a lot of people love it. It has been a long time. I saw it. You know, it's probably as a teenager. I've seen it maybe two or three times, and it's never left a mark on me like it does a lot of people. But it's been a while since I've seen it. But this song, I also have to confess, not the biggest fan of this song, mostly because I love the original Tears for Fears version, and I love just the madness. It's almost like you're losing your mind listening to that song, just how crazy it sounds. And so, you know, compared to, as you said, this kind of sad boy version, I'm not as partial to it, but it, you know, it fits the movie, of course. But oddly enough, I don't associate the song with Donnie Darko on first thought. I associate it with Gears of War. I don't know if you remember the TV commercial. Yeah.
I was going to say the commercial for the Gears of War game, the first one. Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, yeah, this version of this song has legs. It's had a lot of legs over the years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been used in a bunch of other movies and shows. Again, the Gears of War trailer, people just love that trailer so much. And if you think about it, you know, it's a song that is ahead of its time, because how many movie trailers in the past decade have we had the sad, slowed down piano cover of a pop song? Dozens and dozens of them. And I think we can call this song Patient Zero, Paul.
I've never had that thought, but yeah, you might be right there. Yeah, that is a trend that I am sick to death of, and I roll my eyes at it, because it's like you hear it every week some new trailer does that. But yeah, this definitely had some influence.
Yeah, but all right, well, those were our picks. That was the episode. It was a lot of fun, man. A cinematic tour de force. We may be up for that Golden Globe for Best Podcast next year. Who knows? But Paul, thanks again for coming on, man. This was great.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That was a lot of fun.
Before we do plugs, do you have any movie recommendations you want to give out? Anything you've seen lately that you want to give a shout out to?
Well, I just rewatched One Battle After Another in my hotel room the other day, and that still holds up. It might be my favorite movie of the year, but my other contender is this wonderful Iranian film called It Was Just an Accident. It won the Palme d'Or, and it's just this really kind of like small scale, but really it presents a very interesting ethical dilemma that I think people would be interested in. And the director made it technically illegally and was sent to jail after its release. So yeah, you should go watch it for that reason.
Yeah, you know, besides One Battle After Another, of course, I thought Train Dreams was incredible.
I still need to see that. Yeah, I've heard it was good.
I thought Joel Edgerton was robbed of a nomination for the Oscar. He was so great in that movie. I saw a movie a few weeks ago on Netflix that I loved. It's called Left-Handed Girl. It's about this little girl living with her big sister and her mom in Taiwan, and the challenges that they all face. It's co-written, produced, and edited by Sean Baker. And the director is this woman named Shi Ching So, who produced The Florida Project with Sean Baker. And there are a bunch of similarities with, you know, Florida Project, but it has a lot more charm to counterbalance the grimness, I guess. But that's an excellent movie. And there's another movie as well that came out a few years ago. I can't say enough good things about it. It's called Thelma. June Squibb plays this grandmother who is scammed out of $10,000 by one of those, you know, help me grandma, I'm in jail phone scams. And she decides to track down the scammers and get the money back. It's got Richard Roundtree in his last role, Parker Posey, Clark Gregg, Malcolm McDowell, great cast. They turn June Squibb into an action star by having 90-year-old person action sequences like going up the stairs and rolling across a bed. You know, it's one of the best setup and payoff movies I've ever seen. So yeah, I love that movie, Thelma. So check that one out as well, folks. So
yeah, those sound interesting.
But any plugs you want to give? Paul, go right ahead.
Yeah, you can find most of my work at my my shoot job, and I work at a DFW TV station called WFAA. And most recently, I interviewed the Hardy Boys. Aside from that, just a lot of been doing a lot of non-wrestling work related to things like ICE's presence in cities and things like that. So a bunch of different topics you can explore if you Google my name at WFAA.
All right. Well, Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, of course, all the great shows on there. VoicesOfWrestling.com, previews, reviews, articles, things like that. Blue Sky at Music of the Mat and at Just Andrew on Blue Sky. If you want to leave a comment about this episode, share your picks. VoicesOfWrestling.com/Discord. That's also where I post the Spotify playlist for each episode. And of course, make sure you subscribe to the show on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast player of choice, and leave a nice rating and review. All right, so for the playout song, I went with an original song from a Pixar movie, and there's plenty to pick from with Pixar. They have quite the soundtrack in their catalog. This is my man Peter Gabriel and the Soweto Gospel Choir. They did a song for WALL-E. This is Down to Earth. Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you.
Did you think that your feet had been bound by what gravity brings to the ground? Did you feel you were tricked by the future you picked? Well, come on down. All these rules don't apply when you're high in the sky, so come on down, come on down. We're coming down to the ground. There's no better place to go. We got snow upon the mountains, we got rivers down below. We're coming down to the ground. We hear the birds singing in the trees, and the land will be looked after. We send the seeds out in the trees.
Music of the Mat is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The songs used throughout this show are property of their respective copyright holders.
Wrestling Omakase brings you a full course meal of all of Japanese wrestling, men's and women's. Join me, a Japanese wrestling fan for over 20 years, along with a rotating cast of equally knowledgeable co-hosts, as we cover everything from New Japan and Stardom to NOAH, All Japan, DDT, Tokyo Joshi, Marigold, Sendai Girls, Dragon Gate, Glate, Ice Ribbon, and even more stuff. If you're a fan of Japanese wrestling and you want coverage of the entire scene in one podcast, check us out right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network each and every week. Get us wherever you get podcasts today.